The student works of great composers would often display elements of the masterworks that were to follow, and were often great in their own right. This is Student Composer of the Month, where we go in-depth with composers currently studying or who have recently studied in the greater Baltimore area, here on WBJC.com. Today we have a composer who graduated from Peabody with his master's degree in 2016, but continues to pick the brain of other composers, so is a continual student of composing and a student of life, as he said. Peter Dayton, welcome into the WBJC studios.
It's a pleasure to be here, John.
So, you went to Peabody for your master's, and Vanderbilt was your undergrad?
That's right. 2014 to 2016, I was at Peabody for a master's in composition. I studied with Michael Hirsch, and then he took a sabbatical the second year, so my second year was split between Jason Eckert, who I believe is at CUNY, don't quote me on that, though, and
that's all right.
Amy Beth Kirsten, who came in as well. And then, yes, I was at Vanderbilt University from 2008 to 2012.
And who did you study with at Vanderbilt?
Vanderbilt has a rotating system, so you study with all of the composition faculty. The composition faculty there are Michael Curick, Michael Alec Rose, Michael Slayton, and Stan Link.
That seems like a good way to do it, to have you rotate between the different professors just to get a different perspective from each of them.
From an undergrad point of view, I think it's really helpful. And Vanderbilt is an undergrad only, has an undergrad only music program.
Right.
And so I think for someone focusing on the development of basic rudiments of craft, I think it is helpful to have a rotating perspective and maybe not get stuck in a certain kind of musical orthodoxy.
Right. So I would imagine that the undergrad composition study would be the process of sort of finding your voice, and then grad school would be more of developing it, what you have found.
That's a fairly good way of putting it. Stan Link at Vanderbilt University put it very well, saying that at the graduate level, really your comp teacher should be something closer to a therapist, in the sense that you are bouncing ideas off of them and they are really helping you reveal something about yourself, mostly by asking perceptive questions that draw things out of you rather than tell you how to do things. Though I think that they're, especially when it comes to elements like the business of music and certain things that might not have gotten picked up in an undergrad education, because there's so much to teach in terms from everything from orchestration and instrumentation to working with choruses to different kinds of chamber music, and just instrumental idioms themselves are things that take often as much time and experience as it can be sitting in a lesson to learn about.
Interesting. So what formal composition education did you have before college?
Nearly none. I took a semester, little less than a semester, I'd say, of private composition lessons from an adjunct teacher at University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music. I won't name the professor because it was not a positive experience.
Uh-huh.
So I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, originally. Went to a private school that was very academically focused and very academically rigorous. Almost no arts funding and not much of an arts experience there.
That was going to be my question. At a private school, you would expect it to have more arts funding. That you normally see that more in private schools than in public schools.
It's all about the priorities of the donors, though. So
of course,
our school has an amazing photography department.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really nice, I'm going to mess up the terminology, but like DSLR cameras. Does that sound right?
DSLR, I think, is the proper term.
Okay, so really, really nice cameras. Because
I might be messing that up too.
A really rich donor just donated a bunch of money for the purpose of cultivating a photography department.
As they would do.
But for chorus or for, you know, the musicals were, we had a lot of fun with them.
But
and we did our best.
No real interest in that from people who would be bankrolling that.
That's right. Exactly. So so my interest was completely self-generated and self-sustaining. But I looked up and was reading a number of composition books, mostly, though, just to learn the basic rudiments of vocabulary. You know, what are the names of chords? What is a, you know, progressions? counterpoint, I think, was a little much for me to try to grapple with on my own.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I went, I had this adjunct teacher for a little bit, but mostly he made it seem like too daunting a task for me to compose in a way. He seemed to enforce this idea that one needed to have had an undergraduate level education in composition before you could start writing. And of course, that's not the way that
right.
I think anyone starts creating. You start doing it, and then you realize, oh, there are some basics I might need to learn as part of this.
You start,
and then you do.
You start creating, and then you learn how to sort of properly create, so to speak. If one can properly create at all, if there is a proper way to do it, which I don't think there necessarily has to be a proper. There is a practiced way, such as, you know, building blocks of music theory and such, but the proper way to create would be the way that your voice resonates best, to use the singerly term.
Right. There's there's no such thing as right or wrong in music. There's usually just, or at least in art, there's no such thing as right or wrong. There's simply consensus, which is not quite the same thing. And it's important
right.
that we not enforce our consensus like it is a completely intractable dogma.
That's a mistake often made in many businesses regarding music.
Sure. Of course it is. Well, and in art in general, of course. I mean, I think one of the biggest mistakes in music education is this strange separation of music theory from music history. Because in fact, when we're studying, quote, music theory, it is simply a it's simply a style study of music history. It is enumerating or codifying the techniques which we have observed in the works of composers in the past. And of course,
and they've come to be accepted as the way that music is supposed to work.
Right. And of course, we're talking about Western classical music because
yes.
this is not comprehensive for music in general. And I think that's something that at this moment in history, people are becoming more cognizant of is the lack of universality of the Western classical tradition.
Yeah, just like how vocal pedagogy is based on Western classical singing.
Right. 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 One of my one of the most interesting experiences I had back in, I guess, March, when I was at the American Choral Directors Association Eastern Conference, was attending a seminar presented by Fayed Siadat, who is a composer and publisher, especially of sort of more experimental choral music. And he was talking about the different forms of vocal technique in singing, and how looking at, from an international perspective, at different ways of forming vowel sounds and of articulating certain timbres, that there's really an entire spectrum of vocal color that we've mostly eschewed in favor of the British pure vowel sound, choral.
Italianate. You
know, Italianate, but and especially in choral music.
Music, British, yeah, absolutely.
Right, the very pure waveform sound without much overtone. But if you look at Baltic music, for example, there's a very kind of square sound to, or like a very bright sound, which actually highlights certain overtones in a way that gives a completely different color to it. But part of I think our present challenge is really deconstructing our own assumptions about what is good, and separating that from what is simply habitual.
Right. And I think, even on this side of the pond, perhaps talking about diversity of vowel usage, we could talk about Roomful of Teeth.
Right.
And how they don't just use the five pure Italianate or the seven pure, or however many pure British vowels there are when it, they expand into the A vowel, actually makes a very nice sound that they do, but it's not the traditional choral standard that they use, and I think it works great.
Right. Well, and it's part of the interpolation of extended techniques into vocal music as well. I mean, we've been doing, you know, harmonic glissandi since at least the Firebird, if not before.
Right.
But for the voice to do a harmonic glissando of that kind just means you change your vowel sounds, like no, same note but different
right.
mouth sounds, which create
it's a different
similar
vowel.
Effect. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's yeah. similar. I mean, it's same pitch, different vowel.
Yeah, so. Exactly. So getting back to your compositional education, so you like to pick the brain of composers every now and then. How often would you say to do that? How often would you say you do that?
It's somewhere between, it can be kind of a cluster of people that I reach out to, or it can go sort of long periods without it. You know, as many other composers do, I've often gone to summer festivals or this kind of thing. So
are you going to one this summer?
No, not this summer. I'm going to a number of conferences. Like next week, I will be in Louisville, Kentucky for the Guitar Foundation of America National Conference. But that's going to really try to promote my guitar music.
Mm-hmm. This will have already happened by the time this goes up, by the way.
Cool. So I'll be, for clarification, I'll be in Louisville from the 18th to the 23rd-ish mm-hmm. of June. But I mean, most recently, I took a little trip up to Philly to talk to Jennifer Higdon. I had applied for Curtis this past year, and got the chance to meet her through that. And you know, as much as there is, I think, there's an advantage to consulting with other composers about your music itself. If you have specific questions, I've been reaching out to composers more on the front of business of understanding the trajectory of their careers. Mm-hmm. I have the way I presented it to her, and it's a tool that, or it's a way of putting it that I like, so I'm going to keep saying it, is that in biographies and especially in interviews about composers, we often hear about, I would say, the stages of their life that are A, B, C, and then we skip to K because uh-huh. we want to, because audiences are very interested in the creative process. They want to know about what makes an artist and how an artist comes into being. So we hear about their origins, why, how they began, all this kind of stuff. And then we somehow skip to the part where they won the Pulitzer. And so,
right.
And so I wanted to pick her brain about stages D through J, you know,
right.
to the nitty-gritty that would be very boring, I think, to many audiences, but is pretty essential because it's not something, even in school, that I feel like I had much insight into.
I think business is quite an under-discussed element of the whole thing of being a professional musician, whatever instrument you play or whether you compose or not. I think that's actually a quite valuable thing to get insight into.
Part of it is that the paradigm is shifting, but part of it also is that there does not seem to be a particular set way to do it. If there was a formula, we'd all be subscribing to it and doing it, and it would work. It would be basically the same as the trajectory of a lawyer, where you go to law school and then you intern or have a fellowship or whatever the term is. At a firm over a summer, and then you hope that they hire you, and then they hire you, and then you're set.
And then consequently, new music would probably be a whole lot more boring.
Yeah, well, exactly. It would certainly be nice if there was a little more infrastructure, but I don't even know what it would look like.
Right.
But in some ways, the answers are... I've also been corresponding mostly through email with the freelance composer Alex Shapiro. She's based out of Washington State, and really, really wonderful woman. I met her at a summer festival at the Wyoming Festival, mm-hmm. which takes place in Grand Teton National Park. That's a really good festival, I think, for focusing on. It's a small group of people, and often summer festivals like the ones in Europe are just massively bloated. Too many people for you to possibly either meet and make really substantial connections, or also to get your music looked at with much substance. That's my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Having done some European festivals as well. And also you're out in nature, and there's just a lot of, you know, it was a beautiful time. Anyway, so I met Alex there, and have been picking her brain a little bit about that too. But part of it is simply maximizing your exposure, and that's not something really I think that is emphasized in music education. I think there's a lot of focus, of course, on your craft and what you're doing, but it's definitely a case of a tree falling in a forest.
Right.
That no one else is around. So it's hence why I'm you know, I've sent my music to WBJC. I've been sending my CDs as they're released to classical radio stations all over the country, as well as to international contacts.
And, you know, it helps that you are publishing your music in, you know, audio listenable form, and it's actually quite radio friendly, which, you know, some composers might cringe at that notion, but I think radio friendly does not need to mean plain or anything like that, because your music is quite interesting. And from it comes from quite a few different labels as well, which I think is interesting. So your solo record here, of all your compositions, is on Navona, who I've actually seen another Baltimore composer published on that label. How did you come to work with them?
Really? Who's the other composer? I'm curious.
Tad Russo.
Okay, so I don't know Tad. That's interesting. I came to Navona through the...
Have I been pronouncing it wrong the whole time?
I have no idea. I came to this record, whose pronunciation might be variable. They're a sub-label of Parma Records.
I see that, yes.
So I came to them through the DMV Area Recording Group Arts Laureate Incorporated.
Okay.
So I don't know if Tad worked with them, but they introduced me.
Hence why Stephen O'Connor was an engineer on one of them, and he has done recordings for me as well.
Exactly. So while Parma often exert some creative control over the recording process, mm-hmm. the way this worked, because Arts Laureate has worked as their sound engineers before, I recorded the material for the album, and then we came to Parma with the full album sort of already created, and they took it from there.
Mm-hmm.
Arts Laureate was my a foot in the door, if you will, or my affidavit of, you know, quality and of substance enough that they were interested in pursuing the project further.
They and trust those engineers.
Exactly. And so I think if I ever have any influence, I hope to use at some point, I hope to use that to help other composers along, because we're simply living in a world where there is so much music. There needs to be something in addition to the quality of the work itself to differentiate you. And the recommendation of someone who has connections can often be that thing which makes a real difference.
Absolutely. In the music business, it's who you know. It is. It's absolutely who you know. I see, you know, it's, of course, it's in on my end of it, it's singers who have management are always going to get the roles before somebody who doesn't have management.
Exactly.
Or if you meet somebody who can introduce you to somebody, then you're much more likely to get work.
And the, my desire to commercially record has been in order to increase my visibility so that I might know more people who, or so that more people might know my music. I have been as often as I can regularly attending, national conferences, Chamber Music America, coming up Guitar Foundation of America, American Choral Directors Association, Violin Society of America, trying to get to know more people in person who might be interested in my music.
Mm-hmm.